The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
You know, when we take science and study science in school, we're taught these ologies, biology, geology, astronomy, and so forth. But in a very real way, the big questions, answers to the big questions, involve linking those disparate fields.
Evolutionary biologist Neil Shubin tells us how life on Earth has been shaped by a succession of cosmic accidents. And...
It seems absolutely ludicrous, doesn't it? Looking back on it, to call my old man a psychopath.
Yeah, he was. You clearly look up to him and think he's great.
He was a nailed-down psychopath, Alan.
Psychologist Kevin Dutton tells us what a psychopath is and how to learn from them. We'll also be discussing this week's news, including the 30th anniversary of GM crops and a play all about that controversial character, Galileo. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. In 2006, scientists announced that they'd found a fossil of a very strange crocodile-like animal in the Arctic ice. The animal, named Tiktaalik rosei, lived 375 million years ago, and it became an icon of evolution in action. It was a fish that had dragged itself onto land. The team that found the fossil was led by the University of Chicago biologist Neil Shubin, who wrote the story of Tiktaalik into his celebrated book, You're in a Fish. Shubin is back now with a more ambitious book. In The Universe Within, he uses the living world to tell the story of everything that's ever existed, starting with the Big Bang at the beginning of the universe and stretching through to the evolution of life. He came in to tell The Guardian's James Randerson all about it.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Professor Shubin. Your latest book... The Universe Within, it really has a kind of epic scale to it. I mean, at one point we're sort of zooming into embryology, at another we're zooming out to Venus, our sort of planetary evil twin, and then the next minute there's mutations in the biological clock, and then the few fractions of a second after the Big Bang. Why did you take on this huge task?
That was utterly intentional. And the idea and the inspiration and the idea were linked by decades of looking at rocks and bodies. I mean, that's what I do for a living. I spend my summers in the field looking inside rocks to find fossils. During the winter, we work on DNA and molecular biology and developmental genetics to understand, you know, the regulatory genes that drive development and in part evolution. And I've been thinking about, over those decades, actually, you know, the links between different fields of science. You know, when we take science and study science in school, we're taught these ologies, biology, geology, astronomy, and so forth. But in a very real way, the big questions are answers to the big questions involve linking those disparate fields, that the boundaries among them are really seamless, and they're unified by the questions we ask, less the techniques. So the spirit of the book was very much, okay, what are the big questions? And the big questions is, why are we here? Why do we look the way we do? And answers to those that particular question and the many subsets of questions embedded in there really involve an integrative approach. And so the goal of the book, and one part of it, was to emphasize that spirit of how science and its important questions like climate change and evolution and biomedicine are all really integrated approaches.
And you're obviously a paleontologist, evolutionary biologist, but you're tackling here topics like cosmology, a bit of dark matter, etc. Did you learn a lot putting this book together?
Yeah, I did. You know, the book represents sort of my passion, actually. Since I was a kid, my introduction to science, if you would ask me when I was 12 years old what I wanted to be, I would have been an astronomer. My mom bought me a telescope when I was 11, and ever since then I've been interested in observational astronomy. I've been looking at the stars, and at one point it struck me, you know, that really discriminating among stars and galaxies and nebulae, just visually detecting pattern, it's very similar to discriminating fossils in the ground. You know, and then conceptually, there's a deeper discrimination as well, because when we're looking at stars, we're seeing history in the sky above our heads. Not just history; that light is, you know, the real deal. It's ancient stuff hitting our eyes. And I'm also, as a paleontologist, that struck me as beautiful. And being a paleontologist, looking at the stars, and inspired by astronomy in many ways in my own work, really informed the book in many ways.
And there's quite a cast of characters here. You've got Galileo, Laplace, Carl Sagan, Darwin. But also there are some sort of less well-known people in there that I enjoyed hearing about people I'd never heard of before, Preston Ursell Cloud Jr., for example, and Philip Darlington. I mean, he seemed like an incredible character.
Yeah, Darlington, Mr. I threw the rogs, the frogs off the roof of the Harvard Museum of Zoology.
That is extreme empiricism, I think.
Yeah, that was the beautiful thing. I mean, he wanted to test a hypothesis. How did frogs get dispersed around the globe? And so he took a bucket of frogs and, you know, started throwing them one by one off the roof of the MCZ.
And they lived,
yeah. And, you know, what was beautiful there was he was showing something scientists have been thinking about since Galileo, which is how important body size really is to not just withstanding a fall, but to all aspects of life itself. Yeah, so my inspirations for the book, just getting back not only to the integrative nature of science, but also that science is a very human enterprise, that we are in the process of discovery, that we fumble around quite a bit. Sometimes we rediscover old ideas. Sometimes they're discovered in parallel. Sometimes the simple trajectory that we learn about in school is not always the one that represents truth.
These sort of lesser known scientists, did you sort of set out to find people that you, or were you on the lookout for interesting stories like that, or were they just things that you happened to know that fitted into the story?
A little bit of both. So much of the book was also discovery too. For each chapter, I spent a few months. I knew the topic well, but I really spent a while on the narrative. You know, how would I approach each story, whether it's plate tectonics or the formation of the solar system or what have you? And in that, I usually discovered people who I felt were underappreciated, yet whose discoveries were seminal. Henrietta Leavitt, for example, who gave us a ruler for deep space. That's just such a fabulous story. Here is a woman working around the turn of the century, 1912, at the Harvard Observatory. Working, crunching data in this giant lab, and here she discovers this unbelievably important tool, which led us to understand just how vast space is. And without that, we really wouldn't have our knowledge of, you know, the vastness of space and time. So it was characters like that which really caught me, you know. And so they caught my fancy, but then they just became fun to write about. So I figured if they're fun to write about, they'll be fun to read about.
And you're probably best known for the discovery of Tiktaalik and its description in the literature in 2006.
In the, I brought it with me for the podcast.
Oh, right.
It's in my bag behind me.
Okay.
You can't see it, but it's in the bag.
Okay, I'd like to take a look later on. So obviously, you know, this transitional form between fish and land-dwelling animals, or another way of putting it, the first fish that could do a press-up. Can you tell us a bit more about you know, what we've learned about Tiktaalik since then? Because that was a huge news story back in 2006.
Yeah, I mean, so Tiktaalik was there's two stories to Tiktaalik. One is what it tells us about the transition from life in water to life on land, and the other is its discovery story. And its discovery story, in many ways, is more important because really it was an intentional find. We had planned it. We had used the knowledge of the geological record. We had used the knowledge of evolution. We'd used the knowledge of fossils that other colleagues had found in Eastern Europe and in Quebec and other places to predict where we would likely find a flat-headed fish with fins. And it took us 6 years, but we did that. In the years since Tiktaalik, other creatures have come to light, some of which we knew partially before. There's one creature called Pandorichthys from Eastern Europe. We've learned a significant amount about its fins. It turns out to be relatively limb-like. We've learned that Tiktaalik is part of a radiation of flat-headed creatures with fins. And indeed, the more we look, the more we find great diversity in the tree of life. And there are so many open questions. You know, when did limbed animals arise? There's open questions about that as well, which have emerged since the discovery of Tiktaalik.
And just finally, towards the end of the book, you raise a sort of semi-philosophical question, I guess, about, because the book is really about, you know, the connection between the universe, the world, everything around us and our own bodies and how the two are interconnected, how we, and indeed how life impacts on Earth and the atmosphere and so on. And you raise this philosophical question at the end about whether we are now sort of, as human beings, disconnected from evolution because we can control our environment in so many different ways. What's the answer to that question?
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, if you think about, I love to ask the question. If you and I were to take a time machine and come to the Earth 2,000, 3,000 years from now and look at people and ask ourselves, you know, what is controlling how people's performance, how long they live, how fast they run, their cognitive abilities, and just their daily lives, human performance, if you will. you know, what's driving that? Will it have been Darwinian biological evolution, or will it be something else, i.e. human cultural evolution, technological evolution, socioeconomic properties? It's almost certainly going to be, to a large extent, the latter. That's not to say that biological evolution has stopped. We're evolving right now. We're in a constant balance with the microbes that populate and surround our bodies. We have physiological evolution. But the drivers of human performance, you know, that's our ideas. And that's how we distribute those ideas culturally and so and economically and so forth. Those are going to be big drivers, and those are game changers for our planet in many ways. Because if you think about the big changes to our planet, they're pretty gradual. That's pretty gradual stuff. You know, it took billions of years for trillions of algae to produce the oxygen that sort of oxygenated, you know, gave first breath to Earth. You know, but now changes to the planet can happen by ideas traveling at the speed of light that impact our behavior and our choices and our decisions, you know, for better or worse. And so those are the game changers, I believe. You know, the memes, as Richard Dawkins is so fond of talking about.
Some people suggest that this is somehow a bad thing, that we're sort of now mollycoddled from evolution and this will enfeeble the human race or something like that. I mean, you know, is there any merit to that?
Well, I'm a living example of that. I'm wearing glasses right now. I'm here because of, you know, medical advances. I wouldn't be sitting in front of you if it wasn't for a variety of medical examples, and that's true with many of us. You know, so when you talk about evolutionary success, it's defined relative to the operative environment. That's what fitness is. It's not just some isolated variable. It's defined with regard to a specific environmental conditions. And, you know, if you think about what we humans do, we're not only impacting our fitness, but we're affecting our environment as well. So when you think about, you know, what we humans are doing, we're changing both our performance abilities as well as the operative environments that we live in. So that comparison might not be very precise.
Thanks very much for joining us, Professor Shubin.
My pleasure to be here.
The Universe Within, Discovering the Common History of Rocks, Planets and People, is published by Alan Lane and is available from February the 7th in the UK. Let's take a look at this week's science news. Joining me is the Observer science editor, Robin McKee. Robin, we're going to talk about a story you're writing for the Observer this weekend. Well, it's out by now, by the time people are listening to this podcast, about the 30th anniversary of GM crops. It's worth us talking about, you know, how important these things have been to the world, what the promises they held, and then, of course, the environmental battles that have meant that they're not quite have reached the potential that we were kind of expecting. So take us right back. I mean, what, how old are these things? Where did this technology come from? And kind of what's significant about it?
It was mooted more than 30 years ago, but it was 30 years ago that they actually put the first gene, it was a proof of concept, into a tobacco plant. And since things rumbled along quite pleasantly, and then they created the flavour tomato, which kind of had us put a gene inside a tomato and let it, you know, it didn't rot so quickly, and it sold jolly well in Tesco's and Sainsbury's. And then suddenly there was this incredible backlash. About 15 years ago, people felt that, well, it's very interesting. One, I think there was an anti sort of capitalism kind of view that it was big companies that were going to benefit from this. People were asked to, you know, to live beside places where GM crops were going to be planted, and they couldn't see the advantage for them, only for the farmer. And there was a general feeling that technology was just going too far. And since then, there's been the devil's own job in Europe to try and get GM crops in the fields of Europe. And in Britain, you know, we've had trashings right, left and centre, trying to get an immense regulatory process has been built like a great hurdle. And as a result, one of the examples that I'm going to look at is a crop called golden rice. Now, golden rice basically contains chemicals that when they're eaten by the person, they make vitamin A. It doesn't actually contain vitamin A. It contains the prototypes for vitamin A. And vitamin A deficiency is a tremendous. It's a killer. It's a killer of children. It leaves them blind. It leaves them open to all sorts of diseases in the third world. And it's taken 12, 13 years to try and get this stuff onto plantations, into actual giving it to farmers. And it does look by the end of this year that it will start growing golden rice in the Philippines. But for the people who've been involved in this, and that includes the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, it's been an astonishing battle, and years and years and years have been lost when this vitamin A, effect of this vitamin A supplement could have been given to families and to kids.
So just it's worth rehearsing a little bit about what happened in terms of the backlash against GM. Mm. The idea that something is genetically modified in the food you eat seems to some people very alien, very odd. Why on earth would you do it? Why would you eat genes even? Why would you eat DNA?
Yeah.
Which, you know, if you're reporting about science, it seems like a silly argument to make, because we eat genes all the time. I mean, all food is containing genes, but our bodies absorb them and we use them as nutrients. It doesn't somehow enter us and modify our DNA. You were reporting these things, you know, 15 years ago when fields were being trashed, when reports on the front pages of newspapers were calling these things Frankenfoods. I mean, what was the atmosphere like back then? Why was that happening?
It was a very depressing time. It was at roughly at the same time as the problems over the MMR, and there was a dreadful feeling of scientific ignorance going on out there, that people didn't quite get it, or at least people were exploiting a certain lack of knowledge.
Let's just name names here. We're talking about green groups and environmentalists.
I think the green groups, well, I've got a lot of time for Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth, but in this case,
they were wrong. They're
absolutely bloody wrong. And a great deal of harm has been done. There's immense potential in GM crops. GM crops, the word genetically modified is just a technique. It's a tool. If you make something, you could make really bad things, you can make really good things with it. And the answer is, just take the good things and use them, like golden rice.
These guys will argue, of course, and it's a decent argument to some extent. You know, this is a technology that can have widespread influences. What if these genetically modified crops pollinated natural crops, and we had something which was an invasive species, or something terrible happened to the crops we depend on? That's one argument. Another one is that, which you hinted at before, that if you have genetically modified crops, then they are controlled by companies, and companies could switch off the food supply to a poor nation. What do you make of those arguments?
There's plenty of good arguments in those cases. I mean, to name the bogeyman is Monsanto. They forced genetically modified crops into Europe when Europe was not then ready for it. And there is always the fear that it makes farmers dependent upon their crops, and they can suddenly start pushing up the prices because they make these crops that are, you know, very, very good at resisting disease, and you can only be used with their own particular pesticides. That's a very different thing from saying that the whole technology must be ignored. If you want to fight about that over that kind of GM crops and over Monsanto or things like that, that's a different argument, and I'm quite willing to listen to it. But what I find very, very unfortunate is the fact that there are GM crops out there that unequivocally can do good and save lives, and they're being hindered.
You mentioned golden rice. You also talked about golden bananas.
Yeah, golden bananas.
Bananas are golden.
Inside they're very white, and it's a lack of beta of the precursors for vitamin A, which are slightly yellow, and that's why.
What is the potential then for GM? Let's go into that, because back when all this the arguments and things were happening, big companies were talking about these things, and yes, the regulation has been one point of contention and has slowed things down. But have the technology companies themselves been so good at making this stuff happen? I mean, the technology itself is quite hard. It's not simply you put something and it works.
It's very, very difficult. In the case of the golden banana, it's going to take 25 years of research before you get it. And they don't expect a fully fledged golden banana to be ready for being grown in plantations until the end of this decade. A lot of the money has come in from people like Bill Gates. So there's a great deal of charity money. He's doing it because he can see the potential. The world suffers around the tropics from a great deal of vitamin A deficiency and from iron deficiency. And in children, that leads to night blindness, it leads to blindness. There's now a lot of evidence that it leads to immune problems as well.
So this is a huge, huge issue. Also, we're talking about climate change, making crops grow in more saline conditions or in warmer temperatures or with
less water. I mean, these things are going to be required as temperatures go up in the world.
And we're looking at a population that it's now coming up for 7 billion and will be 10 billion probably in the end of the century.
Just one thing to
wind up. It's not the end of the century, been long before then, sorry.
2050, yeah. But just one thing to wind up. I mean, in all of this, frustrations aside, things are going ahead now. Have there been any papers that you've read that make you worried about the safety of genetically modified foods?
There's nothing. No, that's the last thing. No.
And I think that's kind of the key, isn't it? Because there are various dodgily produced papers that no one pays attention to.
Yes.
One was produced last year, which was a waste of time, as far as I could gather.
Yes.
And also in America, these things have been grown for more than a decade with no harmful effects attributed to them. The arguments of the green groups that really are against this surely are just ideological now.
Yes, I would agree with that. And look at Mark Lynas. Mark Lynas, changed his stance.
That's right.
But he got a lot of hate mail for it.
Mark Lynas, the Friends of the Earth campaigner, who actually came up with the whole Frankenfoods arguments back in 2002, three, whatever.
And recanted a few weeks ago.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, we'll move on now to someone else who was a controversial figure in his time, Galileo. Now, down the line, we have Stuart Clarke, the author of our Across the Universe blog. He wrote an interesting post last week about a play. Stuart, welcome.
Hi, Alex. Now, it's nice to be back.
Let's talk about this post you wrote. It's about Galileo and a particular time in his life. It's a play, A Life of Galileo by Bertolt Brecht. And you've had some role in a new version that the Royal Shakespeare Company is producing. Tell us a bit about the play, first of all. What's the story?
Well, the story is it's the dramatization of the events leading up to the famous trial of Galileo, where he was tried by the Roman Catholic Inquisition for asserting that the Earth moved through space. And this went against the teachings and the doctrines of the church at the time. And he didn't move through the correct channels to try and get those teachings changed. And so he was tried and he was found guilty of being vehemently suspected of heresy.
That's a compound sort of accusation. It's vehemently suspected of heresy. It's amazing. He obviously, in the end, was proved correct. And we remember Galileo as a great scientist. Tell us what your role in this particular production was and why you wrote about it.
Yes, the Royal Shakespeare Company invited me in so that I could meet with the cast and talk to them about 17th century astronomy and the astronomers like Galileo and like Kepler in Germany, and just give them a flavour of how revolutionary this thinking actually was, and the difficulty in actually proving these ideas, and just even the difficulty of just getting people to look through the telescopes and see the moons of Jupiter that Galileo could see and things like that.
And so you were a Hollywood style consultant to the RSC, but it's more intellectual than that, isn't it?
It was an absolutely amazing experience.
What's it like though, talking to playwrights and artists about these sorts of stories, which you write about in your novels as well, but you've written about from a scientist's point of view lots and lots of times? They're important in the history of the sort of subjects you cover, and we've talked about them lots too. But what can plays bring that none of us can do?
Yes, I think that where the great value of plays and literature and films can come into this is that they can make a real emotional connection between the audience and the scientists and the science even that's being discussed. Any story has to make that connection with the audience. It has to grab people's attention. It has to engage them. And it has to prove to them that what the central characters are investigating or studying or pursuing is of fundamental importance to that person and allow you to empathize and identify with it. And really and truthfully, that's the core of what science communication is all about, proving the worth of science and having people, the general public, engage with it.
And that's in a way that, you know, just normal journalism or writing about science in papers just can't quite do. If you see these people, you know, fictionalized and going through emotional times.
Absolutely. And I think you have to accept that in the dramatization process, there will be a certain blurring of the facts and the truth, if you like. If the production remains true to sort of the values of what was being discussed in the science, then I think that's fine.
Robin, you've seen this play, not the RSC version, but you've seen this play before. How important is this sort of work, you know, when you're talking about science?
I totally agree with Stuart. It couldn't be much more important than this, and particularly the story of Galileo. It's about scientific method. And it's made personal and absolutely appropriate. It's a wonderful play. It's easily Brecht's best play, and one of the best sort of pieces you can ever imagine about science that goes on the stage. The interesting thing is, I think that there's been so much science on stage in the last couple of years. There's been a real revolution in plays about science, and it's good to have the classic, A Life of Galileo, back.
So, Stuart, are you going to be doing more of this consulting?
Oh, I do hope so. It's just the most fantastic thing to take my knowledge about science and my gut instinct about how important it is, and help people understand that as well, and then watch them just run with it and transform it into something of true dramatic power.
Well, we look forward to reading about more of your consultations, Stuart, in future. The play A Life of Galileo by Bertolt Brecht by the RSC is on at the Swan Theatre in Stratford until the end of March. Thanks to Robin McKee and to Stuart Clark there. To read more, go to guardian.co.uk/science. If, however, you've got too much to read and too little time, why not download the all-new Guardian Audio Edition?
This week on the Guardian Audio Edition, Jason Burke on Al-Qaeda and how great they are a threat to the West now. John Fordham sums up the legacy of the jazz musician Ahmad Jamal, and Brian Logan on Mrs. Brown's Boys, how the worst comedy ever made became a smash hit. And in this week's audiobook review, we return to the roots of cyberpunk with William Gibson's 1984 classic Neuromancer. To download for free the Guardian Audio Edition supported by audible.co.uk, go to audible.co.uk/guardianaudio. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud and Audioboo. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Kevin Dutton is a research fellow in psychology at the University of Cambridge. We last heard from him on the first ever live recording of this programme back in 2010. He was on that time to talk about his book Flipnosis, The Art of Split-Second Persuasion. This time he's here with a book that explores a different state of mind. In The Wisdom of Psychopaths, Kevin tries to tell us that psychopaths are actually a misunderstood group of people, and that actually we could learn a lot from them. Kevin, thank you very much for being here. It's good to see you again. I think it was a few years ago. It was our first live podcast that you were on last time for Flipnosis. Is that right?
That's it. It was in the Science Museum.
Yeah, you were a brilliant guest.
Well, you're
here now talking about psychopaths,
yep.
As is the way for our podcast. We're full of psychopaths. We generally think of psychopaths as a bad thing, I would say, in society. But you want to kind of try and rehabilitate some of that image. So why don't you start by telling us what a psychopath is?
Well, it's true, isn't it, Alec? I mean, no sooner is the word psychopath out and, you know, images of Ted Bundy, Peter Sutcliffe, Jeffrey Dahmer come scything across our minds. But actually, when psychologists like myself talk about a psychopath, we're actually talking about a person with a distinct... When psychologists like myself talk about psychopaths, we're actually referring to a person with a distinct set of personality characteristics, and those characteristics are ruthlessness, fearlessness, mental toughness, focus, coolness under pressure, lack of conscience and empathy, and also great charm and charisma. Now, notice that I haven't said violence there, and I also haven't mentioned intelligence. Those two variables are completely separate from those characteristics that I just told you about. Now, if you have those characteristics and you are naturally violent and you are, let's say, stupid, your prospects, to be perfectly honest, aren't going to be exactly great. You are going to smack a bottle over someone's head outside a bar or even inside a bar. Either way, you're going to end up in prison pretty quickly. However, if you've got those personality characteristics and you are not naturally violent and you are also intelligent, then it's a different ballgame altogether. Then, as the famous Reuters headline once put it, you're more likely going to make a killing in the market than anywhere else. So we're actually referring to a distinct subset of personality characteristics which are independent of a violent disposition.
Now, you talk about everyone being on a scale of madness, these are your words, that we all sit on. So tell us what that scale is. Psychopathy is one end of the scale. Where are most, let's say, normal people, if I can use that word?
That's right. Well, I think that what we've got, I mean, I think that the personality characteristics that I just told you about, if we think of them as being the dials on a studio mixing desk that can be twiddled up and down in various combinations, I think what we have there is, you know, if you turn all of those dials up to max, you have ruthlessness, fearlessness, you know, lack of
We all have all of those.
Exactly. Lack of empathy and conscience turned down very low. If you have them all on their kind of maximum settings, then it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out where that one's heading. You're going to overload the circuit and you're going to wind up getting 30 years in sight, no question about it. But if you turn some of them up high and some of them down low, depending on the circumstances, become, as it were, a method psychopath in the same way that you might be a method actor, then you might be predisposed to have, you know, pretty great success in certain fields of endeavour in certain professions.
Now, I mean, people have famously talked about psychopathic tendencies being behind the things that bankers do, for example, kind of ruthless, you know, cold, unemotional. It's just hard money to them. And perhaps have even blamed psychopathic behaviour, let me say, for the economic collapse. Does that hold any water?
Well, I take a rather interesting line on this. I think that we've got to be very careful when we apportion blame for the global financial crisis. I think, yes, on one level, psychopaths or psychopathic personalities were responsible for it. But let me clarify what I mean by that. Imagine that, making money, making returns is equivalent to driving a car from A to B down a twisty, narrow, twisty road, okay? Now, imagine that the top bosses in the bank said to their investment gurus, I want you to get that car from A to B in 1 minute, okay? And let's say that that represents a return on your money, okay? So I drive the car from A to B in a minute and give you a certain return. Then I say, I get a bit more greedy, and I say, okay, I want you to drive that car down from A to B, down that road in 55 seconds. So all of a sudden, I'm taking a few more risks. I'm getting from A to B in 55. Then the big bosses say 50 seconds, and then 45. So more and more, I'm beginning to get riskier, I'm beginning to get faster, and maybe now some of the drivers are going off the road, okay? Now, what happened, in my opinion, Alok, is that the bosses at the top of the banks got very, very greedy indeed, and they set a time, a return, that nobody could deliver. And that's when all the cars went off the road. And that was the global financial crisis. Now, what I think is very interesting here is that when those guys were driving the car down that road in 45 to 50 seconds and were making a lot of money for people, no one pointed the finger at them and said, you know, you're a rogue trader. When they started pointing the finger was when the whole lot went off the road. So I think, in a sense, psychopathic personalities were responsible, but I think you've got to look right the way up to the top rather than the, if I can use that metaphor, the drivers who were driving the car from A to B.
A couple of years ago when John Ronson wrote his book, The Psychopath Test, he goes around looking and tracking different psychopathic personalities. And there's an interesting stat in there about how many the psychopathic tendencies are more represented in people who are at the top of companies, just as you say, than in general population. But I mean, I suppose, does it make sense for people who are ruthless and kind of cold-hearted and all that, that they would be that successful? They would make it to the top of big companies because they don't have the compassion for, say, not firing 100 people when things go bad?
Let me tell you something that I did last year, Alec. I launched something called the Great British Psychopath Survey. And participants were directed onto my website where they completed a specialised a questionnaire designed to test psychopathic tendencies within the general population. And they were then given their score. But not only that, they also entered their employment details. So what would turn out to be the UK's most psychopathic profession, I wanted to know. Well, the results, I'll be perfectly honest with you, were a real eye-opener. First of all, no surprise, CEOs came out at number one. I have to say, and this isn't going to go down too well with you.
Audio producers now.
Well, radio and TV people came out at number two, actually, which is a little bit worrying. We had surgeons in the top 10.
Surgeons, that
surgeons
makes
were
sense.
In the top 10. Funnily enough, though, doctors were in the bottom 10. So there is a dichotomy between general practitioners and surgeons. We had lawyers there. But more, most interesting of all, I think number seven or eight were clergy. The church people got in on the act. And, you know, at the time I thought, well, this is pretty shocking. But when I started thinking about it, what you find is that psychopaths tend to excel in any kind of situation where you've got a power dynamic, where you've got an organisational hierarchy, where they can wield control and manipulate people. And to be honest, I mean, the church is no different to any other kind of business in that regard.
So all these successful people, given that we can maybe learn some useful skills from them, from the idea that things people are psychopaths, you know, of being kind of motivated and all those things, is it useful to use the word psychopath, though? Because it is a very loaded word. Whatever, you know, you might like to think about the term in a sort of, from a psychological point of view, it's a very loaded term. You don't want to say, oh, I'm going to behave like a psychopath this morning, even if it is for the benefit of everyone around you.
I think that's right. I think the loadedness of the term comes, of course, from the media in many cases. I mean,
and serial killers,
killers and rapists and terrorists and suicide bombers, all that kind of thing. And people, you know, whenever you get that kind of crime and you put the word psychopath up on a newspaper, I mean, it really is. It kind of, you know, really gels it in the public's mind that this is all psychopaths do. I think one of the reasons that I wrote the book is to dispel that myth. And to say that actually this is on a spectrum along which all of us sit. And, you know, I think that's, you know, just like intelligence, like height, like weight, it's just another variable. And there are some situations in which, you know, certain having some of those traits up high and some down low, depending on the circumstances, there are situations in life where that can predispose you to great success. I've interviewed a number of special forces soldiers, for instance, who are high on the psychopathic spectrum, with good reason. You know, some of the things they do, you need to be ruthless, you need to be fearless, you need to be mentally tough and not to have too much conscience and empathy at times. I think it was the writer George Orwell once wrote that, you know, good men sleep soundly in their beds at night because rough men stand ready to do violence on their behalf. I think that there are some situations in which having psychopathic characteristics really do benefit you. But I agree that the term itself is loaded. And that's something which I hope in the book I've succeeded in dispelling.
So I think what's interesting actually about the book is that if that's what you're trying to do, then you start off with quite a sort of personal example. Your last book and this one both started off with stories about your dad, who's obviously quite an important character in your life. And you call him a psychopath.
It seems absolutely ludicrous, doesn't it? Looking back on it, to call my old man a psychopath.
Yeah, you clearly look up to him and think he's great.
He was a nailed down psychopath, Alec. There's no question about that. I mean, he wasn't violent. I mean, he was a market trader. He not stock markets. He was very much like Del Boy. He even looked like him. He was charming. He was fearless. He was ruthless. He was pretty shameless. I never once saw my father ever get embarrassed in his life, and he could really sell anything to anyone. Some of the stunts he used to pull were amazing. I'll give you an example. I remember one time, I must have been about 9 or 10, and we were in an Indian restaurant, and Dad was just about to pay the bill. And as he was about to pay the bill, he got his spoon and he tinkled it against his glass. And of course, the restaurant went silent. And then he got to his feet and he gave an impromptu speech. And he said, I'd just like to thank everyone for coming. I know that some of you have come from just around the corner. I know that some of you have come from a little bit further afield, but you're all equally welcome here. I just want you to know that. Oh, and across the road in the King's Arms, we're going to have a little drinks reception afterwards, and it'd be great to see you there. At which point he started clapping, as of course did the entire restaurant. So we've now got an entire restaurant of strangers who've never seen us before, who've never seen each other before, all applauding wildly because they didn't want to be seen as the gate crashes to the party. city. So as we're going out the door, I remember I was only 9 or 10, I remember saying to my dad, "We're not really going to the pub, are we, Dad?" And he said, "No, of course not. Of course we're not going to the pub, son." He says, "But that lot are, and my mate Malcolm has just taken over as landlord. He'll make a few quid tonight." And that was the kind of stunt he would pull without batting an eye. Now, you can imagine, you know, how much would I have to pay you to get up and even attempt it, you know, but no shame, no fear of consequences, absolutely nothing.
That sounds wonderful. So what distinguishes someone like him, who's clearly a man that you care about, from someone who in our minds is a psychopath in terms of a serial killer, for example? Clearly different people, but you're calling them similar things.
That's right. Well, again, if we go back to the mixing desk analogy, it all depends on, you know, what combination of traits you've got and which are turned up high and which are turned down low. Now, if we talk about serial killers, I mean, serial killers, and not all serial killers are psychopaths, by the way. A lot might be schizophrenic, they might be psychotic, they might be responding to voices from, you know, delusions and voices from God commanding them to kill. So they might also have other stuff knocking about in their personality lockers, like some kind of paraphilias or sexual dysfunction or stuff like that going on. Again, which, like violence and intelligence, is complete, a different variable to the core psychopathic traits I was telling you about. But if we go back to that mixing desk analogy, there is one dial which there is evidence to suggest, if it is turned up high, does tip you over the border from functional to dysfunctional, from successful to unsuccessful, and that is the impulsivity dial. If you have impulsivity turned up rather high or even max, then if you can't put on hold your desire to for instant gratification, if you can't work towards a long-term goal, then there is evidence to suggest that you are going to turn into a criminal psychopath. You are going to behave very rashly and very foolishly.
Well, you're more likely to do something that one day will get you into trouble.
Absolutely right. So the impulsivity dial seems to be the major one that tips people over the border from functional to dysfunctional.
Do you think that your book might risk glamorizing the whole psychopathic bit of world?
I was very conscious of that, and I have actually set out right at the beginning in the book that I in absolutely no way intend to glamorize psychopathy. When you talk about psychopaths, dysfunctional psychopaths, they absolutely devastate people's lives, and I am not trying to excuse that behavior, and I am not trying to glamorize that behavior. I think it's rather interesting, actually, because when you give students in experiments psychopathic questionnaire, especially psychometrically validated scales, there is a tendency among students to actually want to be psychopathic. It has, on the one hand, it has this kind of loadedness that we were talking about earlier, but it also has a kind of an inherent coolness to it, which I think is dangerous. And it's often the nicest, warmest, most empathic students who actually want to be psychopaths. So they kind of, sometimes you can kind of see them faking their responses because they kind of like the label. But that's not what I want to do in this book. I do not want to glamorize it. But what I have done is I have dispelled some myths about psychopathy, and I have laid the truth out in a very accessible way with a lot of scientific evidence for the claims that I make.
Kevin, thank you very much.
Not at all. Thanks very much for having me on.
The Wisdom of Psychopaths is published by William Heinemann and is available now. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. Remember to stay abreast of all the breaking science news at guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.